Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Will Mackin, author of Bring Out the Dog, which is his first collection of short stories published by Random House in March. Will is a 23-year veteran of the U.S. Navy and served in both Iraq and Afghanistan. His writing has appeared in the New Yorker, GQ, the New York Times Magazine, and Tin House, and it's also been anthologized in the Best Short Stories of 2014. Bring Out the Dog allows us to peer through the lens of someone who was there, and to also comprehend the sense of war as it veers from, in this sense, the autobiographical to the fictional. So, hi, Will, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Sam, and thanks for having me.
Sure. Hey, so you've spent a good portion of your life in the service. How did that actually start out, and why did it continue for so long, for over two decades?
Well, it started, and this is corny, but true. I saw Top Gun after I graduated from high school, and the timing was, when I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do. I was a pretty ambivalent student in high school, didn't really have direction. I saw that movie and I thought, that's what I want to do. So I pursued an ROTC scholarship, got one to the University of Colorado and did ROTC out there, went to flight school after I graduated. And I went as a pilot, which is what I wanted to be, but then I turned, because my eyes kind of failed on me in my senior year in college, one of the hazards of being an English major, I suppose. But I was not qualified to be a pilot, so I became like a navigator. And to put it in Top Gun terms, I was Goose, which was initially a disappointment, but later, I mean, I think it came to have its benefits, because flying, I wasn't actually in control of the airplane. I was sitting next to the pilot or behind the pilot. And so I developed a seat-of-the-pants feel for flying because I did a lot of it, kind of understood how the airplane worked, how the aerodynamics, all that good stuff, and the noises, the smells, the feels, the accelerations, and all those type of things associated. But it was imaginary, like actually how to fly the plane. There wasn't a direct link to any kind of muscle memory. So that actually helped, I think, develop some aspect of my imagination that I brought to bear in these stories. And that's a very kind of functional base.
It's funny in the
anyway,
book.
Anyway.
Go ahead. Well, okay. It's funny in the book how you didn't end up buying fighter pilots. You kind of intimate that you flew like the school bus of airplanes.
It was, basically. I mean, it was a carrier-based aircraft, but it's the EA-6B Prowler. It's a four-seat. Navy no longer flies it. I think the Marine Corps might be flying it still, but it's a Vietnam era. Kind of like I described it in that story, but I made it sound like a single-seat aircraft in the story just because I didn't know what to do with the other three knuckleheads. But for, the jet itself was... we called it the minivan of the fleet. There's four people going up flying every time, two in the front, two in the back. I had this crazy ejection sequence where there was a delay. The back seat went first, and then the front seat guys went afterwards. It was just a beast, kind of a thing that was kludged together because in Vietnam, they were having so much trouble being shot down by kind of radar-guided missiles, and the Prowler was developed to jam those radars, and that was the mission, basically.
How did you end up involving music? And it was close to me because when you're talking about Wish You Were Here, I remember, I forget which member of Pink Floyd said it, but he said that Roger can only write about three things: the war, school, and Sid. And I was kind of obsessed with Sid Barrett, too, and I bought both of his albums. And I always was amazed, you know, a saucer full of cigarettes and Piper at the Gates of Dawn. But how did that, I understood it when I read it, but explain to the listeners and readers how that music, especially Pink Floyd's and Sid's, affected you.
Yeah, question. It wasn't Sid so much, though he was the impetus. It was just like Roger's reaction to it and that feeling of loss. And whether it was directed or it was centered around his father, who I believe died in World War II, and, you know, the whole rock opera of The Wall, or if it was Wish You Were Here, which was more Sid-based. But Wish You Were Here was the first one that kind of hit me. And, you know, trying to understand, like, how somebody feels that level of loss. I had a very, you know, I had a great childhood growing up, a lot of friends, a lot of family, a lot of love and good stuff, you know. And so that, when I first heard it when I was 12, really kind of struck me as not just unique, but mysterious, you know. So I kind of just followed that line. I listened to it obsessively, and yeah, it's a thing that I think about a lot, that one line about the walk-on part in the war, or the lead role in the cage. You know, really, that did come up in mind a lot when, during the course, and this is to get back to your original question about how did I spend 23 years in the Navy? One of the things was, you know, I was a navigator, and I didn't really have marketable skills outside of the Navy. So that kept me in. But more so than that, it was kind of the camaraderie and people I worked with. I really enjoyed that, and I didn't think I could find it somewhere else. But then also that line, I mean, I didn't have it tattooed on my arm or anything, but the mentality behind it, the feeling behind it, like, you can go off and, you know, sell kitchen faucets, or you might have an opportunity to actually, you know, fight in a war, like this glorious thing that, prior to doing it, that's how I thought of it.
It's funny because, you know, if you're talking about The Wall, the other song that's been, I guess, my song all my life is Comfortably Numb, because I felt that way about myself in a lot of situations. And I always think about war, and I guess other things that people do. I feel like civilization, or being civilized, is like a very thin veneer. It's like kind of like cream brulee. You can tap it with your spoon, but if you tap it too hard, you go underneath it and the crust is gone and you have all this stuff underneath it. And I wondered when reading the book, because, and I know a lot of it, you extrapolated from your own situations, but like when you zip tied, if you zip tied the teacher who didn't really do anything, I mean, is there a numbness that sets in, and does there come a point where you can do things without recognizing that if you did them in a different situation or context, it would be definitely unacceptable behavior? I've always wondered.
Yeah. No, I know what you're saying. I think that comes later, and that was probably something I worked through when I was writing the stories. But in the moment, I mean, it's expedience. You know, you have to get these things done. You have to ensure the safety of yourself and everybody around you. So that, you know, we didn't actually go raid a teacher's house. I mean, we raided plenty of houses, but that was fictional, that part in particular. But it wasn't out of the realm of possibility, because, you know, a lot of times the intel was not perfect. It wasn't even coherent sometimes. And, you know, despite their best efforts, not to ding on the intel community, those guys did some pretty amazing work. But, you know, not every night they couldn't produce. So sometimes we'd have to piece things together. And they would, of course, have the bias of whoever was doing the piecing together. And if it was a group effort, it would definitely sometimes turn into a discussion. So that was on my mind then when I wrote that.
What, you know, you talked earlier about what your then compatriots, friends, companions, knuckleheads were with you. Uh-huh. And when they read this book, or are reading this book, or read drafts of this book, what were you up to with regard to them reading your work and their opinion? opinion of it? Because we talked a little bit about that.
Yeah. Initially, when I was trying to write nonfiction, I wanted to capture it so that every reaction I got back from the people I was with was like, yeah, you know, like this is exactly how it was. This is it. Which didn't happen, which was impossible. And, you know, so switching to fiction and kind of made it more personal. And there's, you know, everything I've heard back from the people who were important to me and, you know, the ones that I had relationships with has been positive. I don't know if they completely understand it, but not meaning it's above their level. I think they just don't understand why I would do it.
Well, actually, that's an interesting question, too, because as I might have said, you know, I've interviewed Phil Clay for Redeployment. I've interviewed the guy who wrote Fobbit. I've interviewed the guy who wrote Eat the Apple and the guy who wrote Yellowbirds. And it's like I was saying, they don't seem to remember what they did as something that they loved unequivocally. They all seem to have a certain ambivalence about their time there, not only the value or the truth or the whether it was the good war, but also the time they spent there.
Yeah.
So do you have that ambivalence? Or
I have it in the sense that it was an undefined mission. Outside of the tactical objectives that we had day to day, it seemed a little, I mean, it was disorganized the further out you went, the strategy. And so that, and the fact that, you know, it was repetitive when, I mean, we were on a cycle, we deployed frequently. I deployed 5 times, but there were guys who deployed 14, 18 times.
Jeez.
And just saw the same things happen and went back to the same compounds, did the same raids on the same compounds. And so, I, you know, the ambivalence kind of came out of that, just the fact that there was no, it seemed there was no strategic arc, no goal, or, and it's probably still the case.
Yeah. It's like the other thing that goes along with that is, you know, a fear of mortality, which I certainly have. And that was really funny because I thought about when I interviewed George Saunders for 10th of December, and, you know, he wrote the blurb for your book, and he's also one of your great friends. And I was talking to him about, you know, we were talking about 10th of December, one story about somebody who had that fear of mortality. And I said, you know, I have that too. And he goes, well, you know, bottom line is, Sam, you're just going to get sick and then you're going to die. I said, thanks a lot. I guess I just need to go back to my therapist after that.
Yes.
Yeah, but he didn't, you know, mince any words about it. And that made me wonder when I read your interview with him, what about that? I mean, I remember one day my friend and I were putting up this grape arbor, and we used 3 cables, and there was this giant lightning storm. And we were basically there with 3 lightning rods, and we kept doing the work, and we started laughing hysterically because we thought, well, I got to delete that. We thought, because it's a family show. We thought, you know, we were kind of laughing in the face of death. Not that it's anything compared in the slightest to what you faced, but what about that fear of mortality? Do you sometimes just, do you have it? Do you lose it? Does it become funny in a way?
Yeah, I mean, I had it. It would surface at strange times, and not in, you know, moments of the greatest danger. I would say it would be afterwards, when I was thinking about it, or when I was by myself, or, you know, definitely further down the road. And I don't have nightmares or anything like that. But it was just say a few hours after some hairy situation, when I would think, like, okay, if this went wrong or if that went wrong, then that would be, that's when the greatest fear would happen, you know, or maybe anticipating something like that before it happened. But you know, while we were actually out doing stuff, you know, it didn't occur in that same way. Not like as an immediate concern. There were things to be done, just like, you know, you and your friend, when you're working on your antennas, you got to get the job done, and that, you know, for whatever reason, that just kind of overrides the other stuff.
You know, when you were doing that interview with George, I got a little confused because there were two terms and processes that you talked about that I got confused about. One, when you talked about this concept of rotational velocity, and the other was when you were talking about, what was it? Oh, yeah, the third. He writes in a kind of third-order derivative way. And I was wondering why you were incorporating what I considered mathematical concepts into writing. So maybe you could explain those two things.
Yeah, the rotational velocity is that was just kind of built into the system. So, you know, we called it a rotation. It was train to deploy, you deploy, you come home. There's a brief period where you're at rest, and then you train to deploy, you come home. And so there, within that rotation, there was also the daily planning cycle, which, you know, you'd gather the intel, figure out what the target was. It was find, fix, finish, exploit, and analyze. So find meaning kind of narrow down to where you want to go. Fix meaning you're actually there. Finish meaning you kill or capture. Exploit, you get the intelligence that's on the target area. Analyze, you go back and figure out what intel you've gathered. You compare it to the stuff you already know, and you come up with the following day's target. And so it was like a circle within a circle, and within a larger circle was just the war itself, how, like, the Taliban would, in the winter, go across the mountains into Pakistan, where they were relatively safe, train up, plus up their numbers, come back in the spring. And the war would kind of start anew in the spring, and it would, like I said before, kind of the same areas, same targets. Maybe not the same people, but new people filling the same roles. And, you know, so we called it spin, even. Like, there were, not every mission went. There were a lot of things, a lot of contingencies that we planned that never happened. And we would call that process spin. Like, you just get in it and, you know, you'd be in a closed room with a bunch of people figuring stuff out, and it would go on for hours and hours while you're trying to cover all the bases. And that was just spinning. You know, we're just kind of spinning our wheels. Everything around you, just, you know, everybody's throwing in inputs and trying to come up with a plan. So that momentum, that rotational velocity, that's, you know, that just is what I feel when I think about it. It's never an isolated mission. There's always, like, it leads to another, it leads to another, it leads to another, which deployment leads to another deployment, leads to another one, that type of thing. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does, and it reminds me of the story, because one of the stories, because, you know, you're asking for a show of hands, and no one really has an idea, so you end up doing something, but it's not really, it doesn't seem in the story as if it's really designed to accomplish a specific goal. And maybe it is, but it's like, not like you're going through the motions. And I know this, right. I know this is fiction, but it's like, you know, we'll do this because I can't think right now of what else we can do.
It was in that story, I'm thinking about, like, the specific mission, you know, burying the comrade, that was
right.
One of the missions, you know, that didn't happen that way exactly, but that's the type of thing that could take priority, you know. So that's what I was thinking when I was writing it.
It's almost I don't know why I'm going to say metaphysical, but it almost seems metaphysical. Like, you pick something and it's supposed to be something, but it's actually something else. But in some sense, it's actually deeper than what you were originally planning to do. It just has nothing to do with what ostensibly is the system.
Right. And we did have a lot of leeway in choosing what happened, what targets we went after. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. What targets we went after, and in defining the terms of what our objectives were within like the narrow scope. So if we had, say, an IED network that we were trying to dismantle, we could decide within that network what steps we were going to take, who we were going to go after, who we thought would rat out who, that type of thing. There was a bit of autonomy there in deciding what went on.
Go ahead and talk a little bit more, that second concept, which is completely off topic, about George and this idea of his manner of teaching and then equating it to complex mathematical formula. Because I don't know why he did that.
Yeah, well, what I remember specifically is I met him at a writing conference in St. Petersburg, Russia. And the first day he drew this kind of like a wiring diagram of a story up on the board. And I related immediately to him because he had this working class background, you know, and like he'd kind of been out in the world and he kind of gained this experience and he was always a writer, but didn't actually start writing until after the fact, right? And so that was kind of the bond between us because that was my plan at the time, at least. And then the descriptions that he came up with, like how to not just the sentence diagramming, but actually like, okay, if you introduce this character and this concept and that, this character and the other concept, then they all have to cross at some point, and then like where the nexus is, like that's kind of your conflict, or that's your story, or that's your that's where you need to work from, you know. So that's where I got the mathematical idea behind it, and I try to think of stories methodically, like in terms of balance and in that way.
Well, that's interesting. Actually, I can't remember whether it's in the book or whether it's in an interview. When you talk about the parade at the Pentagon,
yeah,
that's kind of a microcosm of what you just discussed. Why don't you talk a little bit about how that parade occurred, what your position in it was, and how you felt at the end of it? Because that was really moving. Yeah, with regard to what you're just talking about, George and his teaching method, like a microcosm of that was when you talk about the parade that you participated in at the Pentagon, and how it affected you, how you felt about it, and maybe you could talk a little bit about the progress of it, how it occurred.
It was early in the Iraq War, and I was assigned to the Pentagon. I was the speechwriter for the Navy second in command admiral, and which sounds, you know, pretty like a pretty big deal, but what it was, you know, he got a lot of the events that the Navy's number one admiral didn't want to do, and a lot of those things were already scripted. So I had a lot of free time. But anyway, I was only there about a year before they sent me to Iraq. They figured out that I wasn't really doing anything. They sent me to Iraq. But during that time, one of the things that happened was they had this parade. They brought in a bunch of injured sailors, Marines, and airmen from the nearby hospital and paraded them around the Pentagon. And all the office workers, we went out into the passageway. We kind of lined the passageway, and you know, we gave applause as they walked by. And the strange thing was just how kind of the parade itself was designed to drive. It wasn't, the irony behind it, I guess, is that it wasn't meant to drive home the seriousness of the war. It was meant to kind of be like an uplifting thing for these injured soldiers. And it started out, the guys, that men and women who weren't, you know, too terribly hurt were in front, and then the ones that maybe had limbs replaced were kind of like almost dancing with their prosthetics on. And then it proceeded to the people who were more injured, and they would be, this one in particular, guy. He was being pushed by his father, and he was obviously not there. I mean, part of his skull was crushed in, and he had a very blank look on his face, and his dad was meeting everybody's eye, you know, like straight looking at people, and he gave us the finger, which I thought, I mean, I understood, obviously, but that kind of drove the point home that this wasn't just some adventure that we were having, which it wasn't anybody's idea if you asked them directly. But I think early on in the war, it was kind of like the first Iraq war. 100 days we went in, we basically cleaned house and left. And having been in the military when that happened and kind of feeling the after effects, there was a very kind of heady feeling. It's very much like we could handle anything, you know, because that strategically and tactically went very well. But this was like the first sign, at least, that I saw that things were not going well and that, you know, the insurgency had just kind of started at that point. And that father's pain really drove it home. It's like, look, you people are the ones that make the decisions, and this is a result of it. And he didn't want us standing out there clapping, feeling good about ourselves.
Right. So to kind of end this, there were two things that I wanted to talk about that seemed like almost, I guess, close to being magical fiction. Like, one was the drone overhead and the sparkle, and the other one was about the owl. So if you could tell those two and we could close out with that, I think that would be really interesting.
Yeah, sure. So the sparkle was, it was on the drones, it was on our rifles, it was it's like an IR or an infrared spotlight that would illuminate, and you can only see it on night vision. So we used it to communicate and signal to each other. We also used it to highlight targets and areas of concern. And walking, patrolling into a target, we do what was called an offset. The helicopters would drop us off however many miles away from our objective in the middle of the night, and then we'd walk in the cover of darkness wearing night vision, and we have a drone overhead that was kind of looking out for us. And if the drone saw something that looked like a threat, it would illuminate it with the sparkle, would drop the sparkle, was the terminology. And the sparkle was a beam. Depending on the altitude of the drone, of the predator, it might be like 15, 20 feet in diameter when it hit the ground. And, you know, one night we had it fall on a tractor when we were walking in. And I remember thinking it looked just like, you know, the magic that turned Cinderella into a princess. It sparkles, first of all, and it's a very odd-looking thing to see drop out of the middle of the night. This beam illuminating something in your path. So that was sparkle, and it was just a whole other dimension. It was part of the thing that I deliberately tried to capture in the stories, was that whole side of the war that was in night vision. You know, it wasn't. There was always kind of layers of perception going on, and that was one of them. And the one that affected me most deeply because, you know, like I described, you could see things in space. You could see, you know, the plasma between stars. You could see meteor showers every night. You could see satellites tracking across the sky. And, you know, you could see sparkle. You could see heat rising off of people, especially if they were running. You could see heat sources. And then, you know, if we stayed out late and the sun were rising, you could see the infrared sunlight that precedes actual sunrise. So that would, the sky would be bright with that. You take off the goggles and it'd be dark as night. And the shadows would reverse at that point. So a lot of weird things going on with that, with sparkle, which was really beautiful. I mean, it just, that captured my imagination. And the owl, that was in Iraq. That was during a strange time. I just gotten there, and I was very, very aware of omens, and just little things that I wanted, that I kind of grabbed onto in hopes that, you know, things wouldn't go wrong. Like for example, one thing was I had like a little piece of fuzz on the floor of my tent. And it was a white feather, and it kind of sat on the floor of my tent. And I didn't want it to move. Like, I didn't want the air to disturb it or move it. I kind of put a lot, and I know this sounds this sounds crazy, but I put a lot of, not attention, but just value in that. Like, okay, if that thing is still there, then everything's cool. Or, you know, it was kind of like a security blanket. And the owl was kind of an offshoot of that. It happened a couple nights. I'm walking home from the DFAC, from the dining facility, and it would be overhead. You know, it probably just, that's just where it was. It's just where it hung out. But it seemed like every time I looked up when I'm walking home, there it was. So in another way, that was kind of another one of those omens. I didn't know whether it was good or bad, but just one of those things I would register.
Yeah, it sounds almost like baseball players.
Sorry,
it sounds like baseball players wearing the same thing and
yeah,
superstition like that.
Exactly. Yeah, it's very superstitious, and you know, and eventually, like the feather would blow away, and you know, I just grab onto something else, whatever I thought might get me through.
Well, you know. All in all, you know, I talked to you about, you know, the other books whose authors I interviewed. This was a completely different, and maybe because you drew, well, I guess they all drew from their own experiences, but maybe it's because of the way you melded your personal experiences in with things that didn't really happen and didn't do it in a way that you were trying to deceive anybody, but did it in a way that it kind of added to the book. So anyway, I own an independent bookstore, and this book is on the front table. And I think it was great, and I know we're here to sell your book, and I'll certainly try and do it as best I can. So thanks very much, Will. I really appreciate you being here today.
Yeah, thank you, Sam. Enjoyed it.
Okay, see you later. Well, thanks for joining us this week. I really enjoyed talking to Will about his book, Bring Out the Dog. It's a war book about Iraq and Afghanistan and his time there. And, you know, this is like the fifth author I've interviewed about their books about the war. And this one was really special because it, I don't know, was deeper in some ways. And anyway, in any event, join us every week, if you will, on the Avid Reader Show. We'll have some even more insightful and engaging discussions with today's most compelling authors. Upcoming authors include Abdi Noor Iftin, who's going to discuss his moving debut memoir, which is called Call Me American. If you want to look for a complete schedule, you can visit us at wellingtonsquarebooks.com, WCHE1520.com, or simply download our podcasts at iTunes or Podomatic. Thanks, as always, for being with us, and we hope to see you or have you with us here again next week on The Avid Reader.